I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Coffee Cup Cantos. I ain't asking for no Cheerios. Last summer, my wife and I were invited to an outdoor concert in a favorite little town of ours. In between sets, the guitar picker decided to tell a joke to warm up the audience, who sat under some old apricot trees on folding chairs in the fading light. I will paraphrase it here. Two farm boys were out pitching hay one morning. The elder, who was 10 years old, stopped and leaned on his fork for a moment. He looked at his brother, who stopped and looked back. "You know what, little brother? I reckon it's time we started to cuss. Tell you what, when we go into the house after our chores, I'm gonna use the word hell. You pick out a word too, all right?" The younger boy, not to be outdone, thought long and hard. "I'm gonna use the word ass," he said after proper reflection, with gravity in his 7-year-old voice. They shook hands on it, and the pact was made. You could take it to the bank. They finished up their chores and walked into the house, removed their dirty boots, washed their hands, and tromped up to the breakfast bar where their mother was ready and waiting. She turned to the elder son and asked him what he'd like to have for his breakfast that morning. "Hell, Mom, I reckon I'll have me some Cheerios." Seconds later, he picked himself up off the floor where his mother's bear slap had landed him and went to his room where he had been banished for the remainder of the morning to wait for his father. The woman wiped her hands on her apron, turned to the younger boy, and placing her hands on the bar in front of him, looked him dead in the eye and asked him in the sweetest of voices, "And what can I get you, young man?" The boy returned her steely gaze and replied immediately, "You can bet your fat ass I ain't asking for no Cheerios." I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Coffee Cup Cantos. A Show of Hands. When my second son was in grade 2, there was an occasion for the parents to meet the teacher one evening. We lived only 2 blocks away from the school, so my wife, the boy, and I waddled through the sycamore leaves to the elementary school after supper. The students had to take their parents on a little tour of the classroom before the one-on-one session with the teacher. My son's teacher was a pleasant young Chinese woman, and I remember that she smiled often and genuinely. When I asked how the boy was doing, she asked if she could tell me a little story of an event that had happened at the beginning of the year during the inaugural show and tell. My wife and I drew our chairs closer to her desk with great interest. It seems that after a long parade of stuffed animals and action figures, it was my son's turn. He had brought one of his books. It was called The Amazing Egg. There were audible groans of boredom from the other children. According to the teacher, my son waited, like Cicero, and let the crowd revel in their abandon. After precisely the right delay, he stretched to his full 3 feet of height and in a strong, clear voice asked, quote, "How many of you think that you come from an egg? Raise your hands," unquote. The teacher riveted her attention on both the audience and the orator, and the children laughed in derision and kept their hands lowered. Quote, "How many of you think you didn't come from an egg? Raise your hands," unquote. The children vigorously raised their hands in unison. The boy cast his gaze around the room as if counting and said curtly, quote, "You're all wrong," unquote. Then he explained from memory the reproductive cycles of everything from sponges, birds, reptiles, mammals in general, and humans in particular. The teacher said she wouldn't have dreamed of stopping him. According to her, about 30 children from at least a half dozen different ethnic backgrounds and several different cultures went home knowing much, much more than they did that morning when they had arrived. Wasn't that the purpose of education, after all? We giggled as we contemplated the supper table discussions that must have ensued that night. After that, my reward for both my boys every report card time was a trip to the local bookstore with no spending limit on a single volume of their own choice. I tossed a few dictionaries around the coffee table and in their bedroom, and I let nature take her course. I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Coffee Cup Cantos. What are the odds? The odds of winning the Powerball jackpot, according to Wikipedia, are 1 in 175,223,510. Another long shot is seeing a lynx in the wild. In a March 31, 2001 article by Andrea Lee Lambrecht of Minnesota's Brainerd Dispatch, I read that, quote, "Only a few lucky people ever see a lynx in the wild. Chances of seeing this creature are slim, yet wildlife watchers, nature photographers, and scientists all clamor for the opportunity to witness a lynx in the wild. Though most of us will never see a lynx, wise management of this mysterious feline will ensure that at least a few of us will occasionally marvel as a mirage melts before our eyes on a misty morning." Unquote. In January 2003, I created a website called Follow the Lynx. In November 2006, a man in Minnesota named Michael Hawes won the Powerball jackpot. It was a shared jackpot with another winning ticket in Arizona. The total prize was $94.1 million, and Mike's cut was $47 million. He was given two options, a 29-year annuity or $22 million in cash, which in Minnesota would yield about $15 million after taxes. The deadline for his decision was February 5th, the day after my birthday. In 2009, my mother sent me a picture which had been taken by her friend a few hundred miles away. No less than four lynx crossing a road in broad daylight. The photo had been taken on February 5th. What are the odds? I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Coffee Cup Cantos. It's in the gumbo. My grandma was a large influence on my life. She was a special one, and her teaching left a big mark on me. Anybody who knew her or met her felt it immediately. She was from a large farming family in northeast Texas in a district called the Piney Woods. She was born in Marshall, and she had my mother and Tyler nearby. She lived briefly in the oil fields of Oklahoma with her first husband. He was a cruel man and a fool. She picked up the nickname Bobby during this hard time from a Native Indian woman friend who taught her how to make gumbo. She left the oil man and married my grandfather, a Swedish seaman. They set up house in Beaumont, Texas, which is about 70 miles east of Houston. Cultures don't respect lines on maps, and the east of Texas from Beaumont across the Sabine River and well into Louisiana is all bayou country. There are several small towns and cities here, such as Nederland, Port Arthur, Orange, and Silsbee. It is a talent factory for singers, songwriters, and musicians. Everyone has heard of Janis Joplin. My grandma could tell you all about her family. Some of you have heard of Ronnie Millsap if you're into country music. He's from Beaumont. If you are old enough, you've heard of Edgar and Johnny Winter. They're local Beaumont boys. Something in the water, something in the air, or maybe it's just the cooking. The place is musically magic. The Beaumont Enterprise newspaper has a regular feature of a daily popular song with the simple chord charts just to help you get off the ground. Everybody there except me could dance. One man from the region you may have heard of, and someday you will, I warrant, is Clarence Gatemouth Brown. He was born in Louisiana and grew up in Orange, Texas, right next door to Beaumont. He lived all over the country in his lifetime and was even a sheriff in a small New Mexican town. He lived in Bogota. He could play blues guitar and he could make fiddles talk. He fronted big bands and played solo all over the world. Any blues fanatic will know of whom I speak, as will any professional musician. He is respected by the best in the business as a player and as a man. Blues was his bread and butter, but one day a Frenchman set up a recording session with the intent of capturing the essence of the region I have been describing to you. He got a couple of Louisiana boys and Gape Mouth together, and they made an album called Down South in the Bayou Country. It is a work of art, and none of the songs on it would Gape Mouth play on tours. These were specially written just for that Frenchman's project. I think he was with Barclay's House of Blues label in Europe. He was a smart man, and he crossed an ocean to preserve something precious for all of us. I first heard the album in a friend's basement. I shut my eyes, and I was walking up the road to the beach cabin smelling gumbo all the way and swatting skeeters. I had to have a copy. It took me 30 years before I could lay hands on a CD. It's sitting on my shelf as I speak, and though I encourage you to get a copy, no, you cannot borrow mine. My grandma sold her house after my grandpa died and moved up to Vancouver to be near my mother. She had her own apartment and more friends within a few months than I had made since 1973. She eventually got stricken with illness, and it was clear that she wasn't long for this world. Along about this time, it came to my notice that Gape Mouth was doing a show in Vancouver at a place called the Town Pump. I got two tickets and decided that me and my grandma were going. I knew that she would love to hear a neighbor sing her back home. We both loved to smoke, joke, and drink beer anyway, and she had been my biggest musical fan over the years. I picked her up one foggy night. The weather couldn't have been worse. We didn't care, and my grandma was all gussied up big time. I had on my best Western shirt with red piping and pearl snaps. We were bad, and we were nationwide. We got to the venue, and this was in the days when a man could park within a block of his destination, not the quarter mile of today. We squeezed inside the joint and scanned around for a table up front. My heart sank. There wasn't a seat in the house. A young lady brought a couple of folding chairs. I was in shock. It was like the first time I heard of reconfirming airline tickets. I was in a Mexican airport, and they gave my damn seats away. I fixed them, but that's another story for later. When the gal came to bring our beers, I asked her to send her boss to please talk to me. A man came, and I told him that my grandma was a neighbor of Gape Mouth and had traveled all the way from Beaumont just to see him play. The girl was strong, but she was near 80 years old, and it would be a gentlemanly thing to do if he'd find her a proper table up by the little stage. The man was a man, and soon we were styling dead center up front. Tapping toes, wiping tears, smoking like chimneys, and washing it all back with ice-cold beers. We were both having a time. Presently, a tall man with a beard like Aristotle sidled up and sat himself down at our table. He shook my hand and that of my grandma. He said he was a Mr. Jim Bateman and that he was Gates' manager. We ordered him a beer. He asked my grandma between Unchained Melody and Keys to the Highway if she'd like to meet Gate between sets. She said she sure would enjoy that. I said I didn't mind too much either. Jim got up and left us. He returned as Gate was unslinging his axe and led the two of us up a steep, black-painted hallway and stairs. He held on to my grandma like any boy from Texas would have done. We got to a little door, and when Jim opened it, there on a small table was a basket of fried zucchini strips, a dish of ketchup, a glass of water, and an ashtray. Gate was sitting wiping his sweat with a handkerchief. On his knee was a beautiful little girl about 5 years old. She was dressed up in a spotless white dress with white socks and white patent leather shoes. Her hair had been artfully braided, and she already had little pearl earrings. Jim introduced us and said he'd be back later. Gate and my grandma shook hands, and I shook hands with Gate. They satisfied each other that they knew the same people and places, and that broke the ice in about 2 minutes. I just kept quiet. My grandma said to call her Bobby and asked who the pretty little young one was. Gate's famous smile lit up his face as he introduced his youngest daughter, Renee. "You can call me Mimi, you precious little baby," said my grandma. "Come sit with me. Let your daddy eat, sugar." Renee looked at her father and then at my grandma's beckoning arms and then back at her father. When he smiled and nodded, she climbed aboard her Mimi's lap. Gate started to chow down on the zucchini strips and offered me some. I chatted to him while my grandma played a counting game with the little girl. "Wire, briar, limber, lock, three geese in a flock. One flew north, one flew west, and one flew over the cuckoo's nest." Renee giggled with glee, and Gate and I laughed so hard we quit munching the zucchini. He offered to get my grandma any food that the kitchen had to offer. She declined politely. Now that they were friends, she intimated to him that she didn't eat that nasty restaurant food. I jumped on the topic and told Gate that my grandma made the best seafood gumbo west of Baton Rouge. Not a person who ever tried it would contradict that statement, in truth. The fact he hadn't had it was probably due to all the damn traveling, I added. Renee begged for another round of wire-briar limberlock while anticipating the big hug at the end of the rhyme. Gate stretched his jaw, looked at his watch, and asked my grandma if she'd like a job. He said she could ride on the band bus, cook the gumbo, and look after the little Renee. Renee clapped her hands and hugged my grandma. Then, with a serious look, she asked my grandma if she would stay with her. I was waiting for the answer, and I could see it written on my grandma's face. Jim opened the door and gave the curtain call. Gate pulled out two business cards from his pocket and gave one to each of us. He said to call Jim if she wanted the job. I still carry that card in my wallet. We followed Gate and Renee and Jim down the long, dark stairs and watched the second and final set. Jim bid us goodbye and took Renee to wait out the show. Gate slung on his guitar and played his very best. My grandma and I had another beer and talked about her new job prospect. All too soon, the show ended and it was late. I ferried my grandma out to the car and began the long drive back to her apartment. She passed away not too long after, and looking back now, I can see she was saving yet another lesson for me until the very end. There is always somebody somewhere that needs you as long as you are a useful conduit of love. Gate is gone now as well, and buried not too far from my grandma. They both had the magic. When I was in my teens, my grandma passed her gumbo method on to me. No weights and measurements or formula that could be written down. It was hands-on, and I knew that to be chosen was both an honor and a responsibility. I will, in my turn, keep that chain going. It's powerful stuff. Everything good and mighty about my grandma is not gone. It's in the gumbo. I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Coffee Cup Cantos. You can tell by their ears. When I was about 5 years old down south in Louisiana, a neighbor took me along rabbit hunting. Our party had a half dozen wonderful hounds and two men with shotguns. We began walking slowly from the frosty backside of the man's property, and within minutes his dogs were on to a hot scent and flushing out the bunnies. I was most taken with watching the canines work through the dry fall swamp, and it took me some time to be able to spot the erratic direction-changing dash of the rabbits. After only a few hours, we were slowly walking back to the man's yard with a good brace of long ears. The rabbits were all laid out on some clean straw, and the dogs were penned up and fed. While the man and his son were busy with this, I examined the rabbits. They were fat, sleek specimens, and their fur was a beautiful gray like the bark on a sweet gum tree. The man and his son came over and began skinning the catch while I watched. The first thing I noticed was that the expected buckets of blood never materialized. In fact, there was very little. The second thing I noticed was the lack of smell. I have extremely sensitive olfactory equipment, and I have logged the smells of everything since birth. After opening the carcasses and removing the guts, I had expected an overpowering stench. All one could smell in the cool morning air was the clean smell of the fur and a very faint aroma of cooked grass. So far, so good. While the men were finishing the process of making them ready for the pot, I was struck by a stray thought. I had participated in a few Easter celebrations in my time, and I was stuffed full of the Easter Bunny myth. I asked the farmer what exact kind of rabbits these were. Cottontails, boy. I felt a wave of concern shoot through me. How do you know it? One of these uns ain't Peter. Peter Cottontail. My voice betrayed my concern and anger at the cavalier attitude of my host. The old man rolled his eyes at the pale sky, looked at his son, and then looked back down at me. Son, I guarantee you at none of these'ns is Mr. Peter Cottontail. His son went through the motions of checking the ears of each head lined up on the ground. Well, now, I done checked them all, little Mike. You can tell by their ears. Understand now, cousin? I guess I'm going to find out next Easter, huh? Thank y'all for taking me hunting. I walked on home, not quite sure if I could trust these men. Later, they gave me some squirrel stew to chow on while I was waiting for spring. When Easter did roll around, I knew they'd been telling the truth, and I was much relieved. My next hunting trip was with my grandmother at her cabin on the Gulf of Mexico. She had spread some carrots around at night under the house. The buildings there were built up on telephone poles, so the floors were about 12 feet off the ground. This allowed for the hurricanes to roll through every season without destroying the furnishings. The lot was chopped out of thick salt marsh grass, and this is where the rabbits lived. She had seen the signs of their activities and was determined to help me bag some ingredients for my first gumbo. She woke me up early as my grandfather used to when we'd go fishing. We got dressed and had a coffee. She had taken two long-handled crab nets out of the shed earlier, and armed with these, we two crept down the long wooden stairs to the ground. We sat on the bottom step, and after our eyes adjusted to the dim light, we saw the culprits. They felt safe, and they paid us no mind. They were bigger and darker than Louisiana rabbits, and there were four of them. They were munching up the carrots right out in the open. They were only one Texas hop away from safety, however. We tiptoed agonizingly slow around the car for cover and took positions behind the big creosote poles. My grandmother tried first, and she bagged one. She giggled like a girl, and I swung my net down on another. My blow landed off center, and the small net covered only the hind quarters of my rabbit. Meanwhile, my grandmother's catch used its powerful legs to buck like a horse till it succeeded in lifting the iron hoop of the net enough to join my candidate in a dash to the salt grass. In the commotion, the two others were already long gone. Grandma said they wouldn't likely be back for a few days, and maybe we could try again. We laughed till our sides hurt, and then we went inside. We decided to settle on a nice haul of crabs instead, as my grandfather had locked up all the fishing gear, including my own, such being his habit when he was away at sea. Thus ended my second official hunting trip for land animals, and I had yet to put anything in the pot. I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Coffee Cup Cantos. The Final Dash to the Woods. One day I came home from elementary school in North Vancouver. My little sister and I had walked home together. When we got inside, my mother told us that we would be moving to Texas to stay with my grandparents. I had just left Louisiana 6 months before and all the friends I'd ever made up to that point in my life. I had left my Boy Scout troop and all my possessions. The house we left in Baton Rouge we had occupied for 5.5 years. It was my longest stay at one address up until the apartment where I write this today. My father wasn't going to be coming with us. I had very many reactions on very many levels to this news of imminent change. There was relief at being away from my father, as well as distress for the same reason. There was the angst of going to yet another new school and making new friends that would surely be left behind in the next family emergency move. I was happy to be near my beloved grandparents, but I was not overjoyed at being a permanent resident of their town, Beaumont, as I had never lived there for more than a few weeks at a time. The gap between hearing the news and being driven to the airport by my father was very short, and there was no time to process any feelings on the matter. We were dropped off, and I remember my father looked sad, but not overly worried. We arrived some hours later and were quickly settled into the duplex portion of my grandma's house. It was a one-bedroom, so my sisters and I slept around the living room. We were checked into school, and I found out that I was to have the same history teacher that my mother had had when she was a little girl, 19 years earlier. I knew a few neighborhood children from seeing them during summer vacations on visits from Louisiana. There was much rejoicing at first, but also a terrible tension running through everything. I was given a stern lecture by my mother prior to starting the first day at the new school. I was under no circumstances to get in the car with my father if I chanced to see him in this neck of the woods. I was to escort my baby sister and make sure that she also knew to avoid her father. I was told that he had threatened to kidnap and kill us children. My mother was convinced that he meant it. We were not to speak to him, follow him, talk to him on the phone, write to him, or go near him. The only bright spot was that he had 2,500 miles to cover first. I was struck by the lack of input from my grandmother or my grandfather, who was at home between voyages. It was as if they didn't know at all about this new information that I had received. I recently found out that they, in fact, didn't know. My father's behavior up to that point in my life of 12 years was such that I was worried for my life on one level, while a wiser part of me suspected bullshit. A high state of tension ensued. Like all children, I internalized it, and like some children with particular training, I blamed myself for this. Several years before, on the occasion of my first friend's sleepover in Baton Rouge, my parents had engaged in a loud, embarrassing argument. I assured my friend that this was not the usual case. A few days after the fight, I was woken up and asked what I thought about my parents getting divorced. I was maybe 9 or 10, and I remember asking them what the word meant. When I was told, I freaked out and cried at the thought of such an arrangement. In the back of my mind was a picture of the girls going with their mother and me going with my father to a life of spit polishing 20 pairs of alligator shoes in between beatings. I had never felt safe in my family since I was in diapers, and the thought of having no witnesses, even of the silent variety, was overwhelming. I really put on a show, and although I can't say it was my performances that kept the split from happening, I always imagined that it had a lot to do with it. Thus, I bore yet another misplaced guilt on my young shoulders as being responsible in part for the present situation in Texas. Most of the events like this in my life occurred at holiday times, perhaps because it was easier to switch schools at that time of year. I saw no joy in the trappings of holidays from a very young age. My grandparents' house was in an old neighborhood, and over the years, the borders that naturally set up between races and ethnic groups had shifted closer to their street. One had to be on one's guard for psychotic fathers and prejudiced individuals of other races when going about on foot. Every walk to and from school became like the final dash to the woods from the tunnel opening under the barbed wire in a military prison. I remember a rich man, younger than my father, taking my mother, sisters, and I around town. We went to a golf course and other fancy places. He asked me how I would like to live like that in that world as his son. I couldn't find any words. I became somewhat withdrawn. One day, I couldn't find my favorite socks in the chest of drawers. I slammed the drawer shut and demanded to know who had stolen them. I discovered that it felt good to slam the drawer. I slammed it again, and it still felt good. I slammed it again and again in a primitive rhythm with increasing force. My mother came to investigate the commotion. She told me she'd rather see me dead than see me behave as or turn out like my father, whom my fit reminded her of. I stopped cold and took that statement inside to build brand new future illnesses with. One adrenaline-filled day, very near to my little sister's birthday, I came up to the white cockleshell driveway and nearly buckled at the knees. My father's car sat in the driveway like a gunslinger's horse tied outside a saloon full of good people. It had only taken a matter of days. He was in bed sick with the flu, and my mother was taking care of him. It was a Kafkaesque arrangement. The next day or so, I was playing football with the boys who lived across my grandma's back fence. My neighbor's big brother tackled me, and I went down hard in a sitting position. My back froze solid, and I wouldn't let anyone touch me or help me up. I walked bent over to the chain-link fence, crawled up it like a crab, and dropped to the garden below. I staggered like Quasimodo into the house. My dad took me to the doctor, who pronounced me perfectly fit. Just a pinched nerve. A few days later, we had a little birthday party for my sister, and within a week or two, we had rented a vacant house 2 doors down. There were no tears, testimonials, healing, nor explanations. It was business as usual. A good old-fashioned family Christmas was had by all just before we moved to an apartment across town. I had to give away my rabbit, which I found several years later had won first place in the local agricultural fair.